Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. In 1986, Sam Baker was on a train in Peru having a great time exploring the world with a bunch of friends.
And we were all young and we were like, hey, we're young, we have U.S. passports, we are invincible.
Sam was talking to other passengers when a bomb exploded in the luggage rack right over his head. It was a terrorist attack. 7 passengers were killed and Sam was badly injured.
I had a cut artery and really went into the whole dying process.
He almost bled to death, and once he got through the worst of it, he had to go through surgery after surgery to fix all of the injuries.
You know, I couldn't think, my hands didn't work, I couldn't walk.
He had constant pain, tinnitus, head injury.
Way too much alcohol and pills and rage. I was addicted to fury and to rage.
And he needed to put what happened to him into words.
You know, when the bomb went off, you know, it flattened my lungs, and I was like, well, how do I describe that? And I wrote obsessively. It was a page after page after page after page of really mostly the same stuff over and over and over again. And melody would come to me. It would come, I was looking for my guitar. It would come to me, and I kept pushing it back. I'd be like, that melody is not what I need. Melody is not what I want. Melody doesn't help me.
What he really wanted to do was process all that had happened to him.
I think looking back, it was me trying to control something that's uncontrollable. If I can define it, if I can give it a name, if I can hold it in a way in my head where I understand it, then it can't come back. Then you and I, as we sit here, the glass won't all blow in and shred everybody.
Mm-hmm. So the melody kept...
And then melody kept coming, and I would be like, right, and these over on this melody was like... La 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 la. And I didn't know what to do with it. And then I'm sitting on the train to Machu Picchu. Passenger car explodes. There's not enough time to say goodbye. There's not enough time to know what's gone wrong. God have mercy, I believe my heart has failed. Smoke rises through a hole in the roof. The dead say fare thee well. And that's what described it.
And I felt it. There was something in Sam's song that was so much more powerful than hearing him talk about what happened to him, more powerful than seeing his hands still gnarled by his injuries. I felt like his song transmitted his emotions to me. And for Sam, music helped him through his pain. It later became his career and life. He is a folk musician and performs all over the world.
There was something in melody, something in singing, that went to a different place.
On today's show, we're looking into that power of music to express things that we can't put into words, to help us overcome illness, and what science says about that power. Our first story is about music as a way to cope with isolation and suffering. When Todd Simpson was 8 years old, he discovered he had a gift for music. And that talent may be intertwined with a difficult genetic disorder and a brain injury. Shai Ben-Yakov takes us to rural Alabama to meet Todd.
I've traveled to Gipps Place in a small town about 20 minutes outside of Birmingham. Gipps Place is not much more than a lean-to with a tiny stage and autographed pictures of just about every great blues musician ever to tour the South. I'm here to see the young man plugging into the amp and strapping on his guitar.
Put your hands together for Todd Simpson, the Mojo Town!
Todd Simpson steps up to the mic. He's thin and rangy with a frizzy blonde ponytail and a piercing gaze. He's wearing a plaid rodeo-style shirt, cowboy boots, and torn jeans. Everything about him is raw, including his playing. Todd closes his eyes and opens his mouth. Rock me, baby. Rock me. His face turns a dark shade of pink as he belts out the lyrics. Rock me, little mama. Come on back. But there's a little more going on here than a blues performance. Todd Simpson has something called synesthesia. That's where two of your senses get crossed. So as he's playing the music, he's seeing colors at the same time. And somehow, these colors tell him exactly what notes to play. He says playing music is like humming.
I don't even have to worry, am I gonna hit that note? I don't worry about it, because I know that note inevitable. It's there. And it's as simple as, you know, when you're humming, you're not thinking, am I gonna, when I'm doing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, hit the right thing? I think if you're thinking about it, you're not gonna hit it. You're gonna be, missed it.
His music evokes ecstatic joy and the deepest suffering. And when you learn about Todd's early life, you can understand where that pain comes from. Here's his father, Wes, talking about the day Todd was born.
It was an uneventful birth. I mean, it was a good birth, and he was a pretty little blonde-headed baby.
But just minutes later, doctors put Todd on oxygen. Eventually, a cardiologist came in and determined his pulmonary artery, which pumps blood to the lungs, was blocked.
And they took him in for his surgery. And when he come and sat down for us, and he said, I'm going to be very honest with you, your son has about a 5% chance of surviving this surgery. I mean, all of a sudden, it hits you in the face, as, you know, when you're kissing your baby, you know, on the forehead before they take him in, and think, you know, it starts to realize, you start thinking, 5%?
Did you think at that point you would never see him again?
Absolutely.
Todd survived the surgery, had a really slow and complicated recovery, but he did finally go home.
And he probably was 6 months old.
He had to be tube-fed, and he wasn't growing well. Over the next couple of years, he was virtually always in the hospital.
He had been in the hospital for over 770 days by his third birthday.
Then Todd started choking all the time.
He had one of the choking episodes where his esophagus filled up. And it freaked out the cardiologist to the point that he said, oh my gosh, this is horrible.
The doctors tried many things to help. One suggestion was a neck surgery to cut off Todd's esophagus and reroute it out the side of his neck for drainage. Todd would not be able to eat like most children do. He'd probably never talk.
And I remember me and my wife talking right before it happened, and I said, you do realize his life is never going to be very normal. You do realize this is going to be a child that's never going to be invited to sleepovers. That's never going to, you know, no girl's going to ever, he's never going to have a date. He's never going to, I mean, you do realize the magnitude of what we're looking at. And we did, but we thought that was our only choice.
On the day, there was a complication, and doctors ended up canceling the neck surgery. But the back and forth, the uncertainty and worry for Todd's future were a big part of the Simpsons' life for a long time. There was always some new scary procedure ahead of them. But after one particular surgery, something miraculous happened.
Well, I came out of the second heart surgery, I'd eaten ice cream. I'll never forget that either. It was sherbet ice cream.
And I'm eating.
The family doesn't really know why Todd was suddenly able to eat or why the choking stopped. But the surgery wasn't a cure-all. Todd would get frequent fevers, it turned out his immune system didn't work all that well, and he had other issues like a severe speech impediment and delays in crawling and walking. The list went on and on and on. And Todd's parents just knew it all had to be connected.
My wife had always just said, he has to have a syndrome.
When he was 8, Todd's parents took him in for genetic testing. And they learned he has something called 22q. Here's Donna McDonald McGinn. She runs a center focused on 22q at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
22q is a tiny piece of chromosome missing that results in loss of genes, and genes determine everything about us, our hair color, our eye color, how tall we are. And in this instance, there are about 50 genes missing from the 22nd chromosome.
When genes are missing, it's like missing steps to the instructions of how the body is supposed to build itself. Doctors don't completely know which steps get left out, But they do know some of the general areas that get affected when you're missing these particular genes.
Congenital heart disease, differences in the palate or the roof of the mouth, problems with infection, so immunodeficiency, some feeding differences, and then many people who have this tiny piece of chromosome missing have differences in learning style.
So having a diagnosis didn't help Todd all that much. He still had all these health problems. He was smaller than everyone in his class. He had this speech problem. And it turned out he had some learning differences.
He is totally dyslexic. As dyslexic as a person can be.
One doctor said the only thing I can think is when he says it, he says Chinese.
But there was one thing Todd excelled at. Music.
So I had a nurse named Valerie, and she would play tons of old blues albums and soul albums. And when you were confined in a room for a long period of time, you know, that becomes your reality.
And Todd, even from a really early age, loved to sing.
When I was in preschool, that became an issue. That, you know, Todd's got to learn not to come to school and sing the whole time.
Music was an escape. And one day,
He walked into a room and a friend of mine and myself were playing guitars, and Todd reached in a box of toys and picked up a harmonica.
And somehow, he could play it.
And we were just blown away. And that was the first really good thing that ever happened, you know, in his life, you know, a positive thing, really.
So Wes took Todd to a local music festival where they met this blues guitarist named Willie King.
He said, you got a harmonica with you? And Todd said, yes, sir. And he said, play me a little bit. Hit me a lick, he's what he said. Hit me a lick. And Todd pulled it out and played a little, and he said, whoa. And he told that guard, he said, I tell you what, open that gate. And he said, he's playing on me today.
So Todd got to play with this legendary blues man. He gets written up in the paper, this 8-year-old kid playing harmonica like a pro. And pretty soon, he's getting all these offers from other blues guys to play. This goes on all through Todd's teen years. And then at 17, Todd realizes he can do the same thing on a guitar.
And, I mean, it's like he'd been playing all his life. And, I mean, blistering leads and stuff.
Pretty quickly, Todd started playing festivals. He and his dad formed a band. Word about him eventually got around, and he started playing gigs all over the South. Then outside of the South.
He had been playing 3 months, I guess, maybe, when he opened a show for the Allman Brothers. And then, you know, and that hit a string. We opened for Huey Lewis and the News, Confederate Railroad.
Sister Hazel.
Paul Thorne a few times.
And now, 12 years later, this is Todd's life. The band tours, mostly in the South. They've got 3 albums. Todd still basically can't read except for some sight words. Music is how he makes his living. Todd's family thinks he has a gift from God. But science can offer some clues about the source of his talent. During one of his procedures, he actually had a stroke. And a stroke can cause the brain to rewire itself.
The brain needs to reorganize itself in order to produce cognitive abilities. And because parts of the brain are damaged, you can get connections between parts of the areas of the brain that normally would not be connected.
That's Edward Moss. He's a neuropsychologist who works specifically with kids who have this disorder. And he says people with 22q do have brains that are just a little different.
So it might be this incredible happenstance of Todd's having 22q and having, you know, a miswiring that somehow brings it all together uniquely for him.
So to be clear, the stroke is just one theory. It could be the explanation for Todd's ability, but it might not be. And Todd's musical gift might just be that, a gift. Todd doesn't really care, and neither does his audience.
Shai, you spend a lot of time reporting this story, traveling to Alabama, getting to know Todd, mm-hmm. but this goes beyond work for you. This story was personal for you, too.
It is personal, Mike, and here's why.
Hi.
This is Amos. He's my younger son, and he has 22Q. He says cat sometimes. It wasn't so clear in that one.
How old is Amos now?
Amos is 16 months old, and he was born with a similar heart defect to Todd's. Not exactly the same and not as severe. So when he was 3 months old, he did have a heart surgery, and he has a few other minor health problems, nothing even close to what Todd went through. He's a little small for his age, like Todd was, but he's pretty healthy and he's a happy kid.
Now, I was very surprised that it took so long for Todd to get the diagnosis. You knew very early on, right after Amos was born, that he had 22q, right?
Yeah, we're really fortunate to be near the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which is basically the center for this disorder in the country. So they picked it up actually before he was born on a cardiac echo. They detected his heart condition, and then he was diagnosed very shortly after he was born. But a lot of people, especially in rural areas, get missed, which is why it's actually hard to get a handle on just how many people have 22q.
Now, hearing Todd's story and hearing about this gift that he has, what do you take away from that, thinking about your son?
So I realize that musical talent like Todd's is incredibly rare. But I think, you know, for me and for a lot of 22q parents, there's anxiety around the trauma that your kids, that you're afraid that your kids are going to go through around all of their illnesses. And a lot of these kids are really, really sick. And talking to Todd, what I get more than anything is that, you know, here's a guy who went through just about everything there is to go through. And he got through it. And not only did he get through it, but he found something he really loves. And he's making that his life. And I think that's all any parent of any child with a disorder or without a disorder wants for their kids.
Thank you, Shai.
Thank you, Mikan.
We're talking about what music can do on today's show, how it can transport us to a different place emotionally. But before we get back into that, here's a question for you. What exactly is music? Is it a uniquely human talent, or do birds make music? Alan Yu looked into this, and the seemingly narrow question led us to ponder much bigger ones.
Hollis Taylor is a composer and violinist in Australia. She travels to nearby islands and out into the desert to record birdsong. That's a pied butcher bird. Hollis gathers the birdsong and tries to recreate it in her music.
I perform it on the violin. And then I started getting asked by other musicians if they could have these pieces, some pieces too.
The Adelaide Symphony Orchestra performed Hollis's Butcher Bird piece last October.
The most common reaction I get from other musicians, especially the ones that are performing the work, is amazement that that the bird song is as complex as it actually is. And I actually simplify the bird song in order for humans to be able to do it. Human audiences seem to be really enjoying them, so I think it's proof all the more that these pied butcher bird songs are music.
Hollis says there's no definitive definition for music that everyone agrees on. But she says if we think about what goes into music, beauty, learning, complexity, bird song has all of those things.
There were many examples of people saying, oh, this bird song is very musical. But it's just like, I guess.
That's Marcelo Araya Salas. He is a postdoc in biology at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He also studies birdsong, but he does have a kind of standard for what qualifies as music. To sound harmonious to humans, music has to follow a pattern, he says. If you divide the frequencies of notes in a song, you find that they move up or down by whole numbers. To our ear, that means something is harmonious. Without this relationship, it won't sound like music. Marcelo says we need to put birdsong to the test, so he did that a few years ago. He recorded the nightingale wren. He found that, nope, for the most part, the birdsong does not have that harmonious relationship, but he's open to the idea that birdsong could be music.
I just tested one species, but I'm just saying that we have to be cautious and we need to be aware of the biological implications of saying that.
It's almost like saying birds evolved in a similar way to humans, and Marcelo says we don't have evidence for that yet. Other scientists tested a bird called the hermit thrush, and they found that its songs are harmonic. But maybe that's not a good criteria. Some composers say being harmonic isn't even a good standard for human music. Everyone knows the legendary artist Nina Simone made music, but listen to this slide at the end of her song, Strange Fruit. Not very harmonic, but still music. Ornithologist Richard Prum wants us to consider some other factors too. He's at Yale University, and he's also studying whether birdsong is music.
Birdsong is likely to be a form of music or acoustical art because the preferences that birds show for particular kinds of song have shaped one another mutually over time.
In other words, female birds are music critics, and if they like what they hear from male songbirds, they reward it with sex. That music then gets passed on to the next generation. It's part of what male birds use to attract females, like a peacock showing off his tail. To a lot of biologists, those kind of flashy behaviors are about communication.
This is like a biological Match.com profile, right? Where the advertisement says things like, who are his people? Does he come from a good egg? Does he have a good diet? All the kinds of things that mates might want to know or need to know.
But Richard says he believes something more than just functional communication is going on. It's also about what the animals find beautiful. He says animals can judge what is and is not beautiful to them.
We've been sold a bill of goods that somehow, just because we can't speak to birds and communicate directly to them about their subjective experiences, what's going on in their heads, that they don't have them.
In fact, new research on the brains of songbirds and parrots shows that birds have a lot of neurons packed into those small brains, so they could be a lot smarter than we thought they were. And so for him, it's not so hard to imagine that songbirds can make and appreciate good music. For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
We're talking about music today on The Pulse. Now let's take a look at the connection between science and music. Over time, many mathematicians and physicists have been drawn to melodies, to the complexities and, of course, the beauty of music. Brian May, the guitarist for Queen, has a PhD in astrophysics. Then there's Harvard particle physicist Lisa Randall, who helped write an opera about the existence of hidden dimensions. And of course, there's Einstein, who played violin. But to Jonathan Powles, a musicologist and amateur astronomer, this music-science bond is deeper than mere association. He says over the centuries, music has often played a leading role in the spheres of science.
Very early on, when we're talking about the ancient Greeks, people like Aristotle, Pythagoras, and Ptolemy, music and physics were seen to be really quite similar sorts of intellectual disciplines. The sorts of models that made music work and the models that made the physical world work seemed to those guys to be so similar it couldn't be a coincidence. For instance, let's take the orbits of planets around the sun. Well, of course, in ancient Greece, it was still believed that the planets and the sun orbited the Earth, and there were some quite sophisticated theoretical mathematical models to describe the way in which those orbits happened and the times that it took the planets and sun to orbit the Earth. And it occurred to those ancient physicists that the sort of patterns and resonances that were created by those orbits seemed very similar to some of the patterns and resonances we find in the musical world. This is where this notion of music of the spheres got born, that there was a sort of musical relationship that governed the way in which the planets moved in the sky.
Later, scientists found out that's not true. But Jonathan says there is something powerful in the metaphorical connection between the harmony and vibrations of planets and the harmony and vibrations found in music.
It actually goes back to the way in which musical sound is organized. So when you have two pitches, the pitch might be la, and then what we call an octave higher than that, la, la. Those two pitches have a relationship. Sound similar, la, la. One's higher than the other, but they're, if in musical terms, they're the same note. Let's say it's a C. Now, what's happening physically is that the higher one, la, the sound wave vibrating twice as fast as the low one. So there's a mathematical relationship between the two pitches, because ultimately what creates the musical note, or any sound in fact, is vibrations at a particular frequency, a particular speed. Pythagoras, the ancient Greek theorist, discovered that the relationship between those two pitches that I just sang, that one was vibrating exactly half as fast as the other. Many physicists have talked about the fact that musical thinking, or immersing their minds in musical speculation, feels a lot like what happens when you do physics. Because if you think about it, both music and physics are non-verbal ways of making sense of the world. They're both about patterns, and they're both often quite complex patterns of numbers, patterns in space and time, or patterns in sound. And those patterns don't have anything to do with words. So thinking musically and thinking physically, they feel the same. And this possibly explains why so many physicists and mathematicians have also been very interested in music.
2 years ago, there was this big discovery which has to do with sound and patterns.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Most recently, we've just discovered.
We have detected.
We discovered.
Gravitational waves. We did it.
Final proof of gravity waves, which are, again, the waves made by enormously massive objects, black holes, colliding with each other and letting off this gravity wave, which you can actually, if you take the data and turn it into something that's in the range of human hearing, you can listen to.
Really exciting is what comes next.
Jonathan says for him, the soundtrack to all of these recent discoveries is music from the film 2001: A Space Odyssey.
And the soundtrack of that movie is legendary and very, very challenging music, very, very unreal and otherworldly. So when I think of this crazy stuff that the physicists are discovering now with sound waves and the structure of the universe and the sort of being able to listen to the sound the Big Bang made, I personally tend to think of that soundtrack. That's what I'd be listening to when I thought about this stuff.
Jonathan Powles is a musicologist at the University of New England in Australia. We usually think of music as beautiful, as a force for good, but music can also be used to distress people. In times of war, soldiers have tapped into that side of music to intimidate or humiliate their enemies. During the Iraq War, troops used music to get detainees to talk during interrogations. Irina Zhurov has been looking into that, and she is here now. Hey, Irina.
Hey, Megan.
So how was music used in interrogations?
So at both Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo prisons, if a detainee refused to talk, one of the things the American soldiers would do is play music. They'd play it for hours and they'd blast it really, really loudly. Jonathan Pizak wrote a book called Sound Targets. It's about the role of music in soldiers' lives during the Iraq War. And he says it was a way to wear down the detainees.
The idea was to sonically overstimulate and irritate them to the point that they would agree to answer questions in order to make the sound stop, and also to sleep deprive them to the point that really that their brain and body functions start to slide a little bit and you're able to create a wedge in between their will to resist.
What kind of music would they play?
Some pop music, like Britney Spears. Interestingly, one of the American soldiers that Jonathan talked to said he was picky about what kind of pop music. He figured out that people in Iraq liked Michael Jackson, so he didn't play any of that. And he relied a lot on heavy metal, things like Slipknot, Mudvayne, Metallica. One of the detainees at Guantanamo named Ruhal Ahmed was on the receiving end of this. In an interview with Reprieve, a human rights organization, he described it like this.
It makes you feel like you're going mad. After a while, you don't hear the lyrics. All you hear is heavy, heavy banging. That's all you hear. Or you can't concentrate on the drums or what the person is saying. All you hear is just loud shouting and loud banging. It just sounds like metal is crashing against metal. That's all it sounds like. It doesn't sound like music at all. So after a while, it just plays with your mind.
The music that the American soldiers used, was that just sort of random stuff that they had on their iPods, or was there an official list?
There is no official playlist. And actually, the soldier that Jonathan Pizak talked to, he wasn't trained to do this, at least not in any systematic or official way.
Do people consider this torture?
Lots of people and organizations have said, yes, this is torture. The U.S. government has not called it that, as far as I know.
But either way, it's really depressing to think about music used in that way.
Yeah, music theorist Jonathan Pieslak says the same thing.
We have very strong feelings about music. It is very much a part of our lives and something that really makes us human beings in a very deep way. And so we don't like seeing it used with malicious purposes.
But does this work? Does blasting people with music work to get them to talk?
It's kind of hard to answer that question. This was not a widespread practice during the Iraq War, and there's not much research to show, you know, if detainees started giving up truthful, helpful information once you blasted them with Metallica. But if we accept that, yeah, this is torture and it comes with all the sort of psychological or physiological distress that torture causes, there is a whole lot of scientific literature that says, like any torture, it would not have produced truthful information. So if people are talking, it's likely due to panic or disassociation and not because they finally decided to talk.
And the information may not be true.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, Irina.
Thanks, Megan.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
University of Pennsylvania's Medical Ethics and Health Policy Department supports The Pulse. Their online Master of Healthcare Innovation addresses the rapidly changing healthcare landscape by advancing innovation among healthcare professionals through online education. Penn faculty who work in health policy, behavioral economics, and operations management prepare students to influence policy, improve processes, and lead innovation. Applications for Penn's next cohort are due February 15th. More at improvinghealthcare.net.
We're talking about music, how it can change our mood and help us get through tough times. A lot of us use music as we get from point A to point B. We listen on the subway, walking to work, or maybe while running. Researchers are trying to tap into that listening habit to help people who have lost legs improve their gait. Paige Flager visited Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Maryland.
Rosemary Salak is about 5 feet tall, and she walks with a slight limp. But she's got a wicked sense of humor about it.
I don't care if somebody notices that I'm limping. It usually turns out to be funny because they'll be, oh, did you hurt your ankle? I'm like, no. I pull up my pant leg and they're like, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Rosemary lost her left leg above the knee. She's an Army veteran who served for 23 years, but she didn't lose her leg in service. She was driving home from work in 2005 during a big snowstorm. She got in a car accident, just a little fender bender, and got out of her car to exchange insurance information with the other driver.
But in the meantime, another car came over the hill and lost control and was going a lot faster. So when she lost control, you know, it all happens very quickly. So I never even saw it happening, but she hit me. the car hit me right in my left leg.
Doctors put her in a coma and operated on her leg dozens of times, but an infection made her too sick to continue operating.
They said it was at that point life or limb, so then they did the amputation.
She says the adjustment to life with a prosthetic leg was difficult, and she was in a lot of pain, but she thought this was just her new normal.
Whatever physical therapy and things they taught me when I first lost my limb, I don't know, I was getting by, getting from point A to point B, but not doing it in a way that was good for my body, so.
She was favoring her healthy leg, and after a few years of walking with an uneven gait, her right knee was hurting her so badly that she decided to come to Walter Reed. They asked her to be part of a study testing a new app. It's called Reload. It was created by researchers at University of Miami's School of Medicine and their School of Music. Each study participant has sensors that they put on their leg, their prosthetic, and their lower back whenever they go for walks. The sensor syncs up with the app and gives feedback on their gait in real time. And since people love to listen to music when they're out for a walk, the app taps into that by distorting the music whenever their gait is uneven. It might seem crazy what I'm about to say.
Roll over your toe.
And when their gait gets back on track, so does the music. Or they can just get verbal cues without music underneath.
These are good steps.
Helping people who have lost a leg correct their walk can prevent problems like the pain that Rosemary was feeling in her knee, says rehab specialist Paul Pasquina.
After a lower limb loss, you are at much greater risk for developing arthritis in your remaining joints, as well as problems such as back pain or residual limb pain.
Paul leads Walter Reed's Department of Rehabilitation. He says there's a big market for an app like this because between 1.7 and 2 million Americans live with limb loss. Even though Rosemary Salak has only been using Reload for 8 weeks, she says it's made a lot of difference in the pain she was feeling and the way that she's walking. She personally prefers to walk with the commands and no music.
I tried the music, and the problem I had was it changed my gait because for me, it kind of put me in the dance mode instead of the walk mode. So I thought, although it's much more enjoyable to listen to the music than it is to hear,
roll over your toe.
Whether she's walking or dancing, she says it's a comfort to know that she's doing it right. For The Pulse, I'm Paige Flager.
Our next story is about a scientist who says efforts to restore the ability to hear should include the ability to hear music.
Through music, you can live the life that somebody else has lived, and you can feel what they felt.
That's neurosurgeon Charles Lim, and a lot of his patients get cochlear implants. These implants are different from hearing aids, which make sounds louder. Cochlear implants replace damaged parts of the inner ear. They send electric signals to the hearing nerve to provide sound signals to the brain. They can give sound to people who've always been deaf or bring back hearing to those who've lost it. But Charles says things don't sound the same as they did before.
Most patients would say, wow, this sounds really pretty different from what I remember. And some would call it more digital, somebody would call it more electrical, but I think the bottom line is that it is an artificial form of hearing, and it's far from perfect.
The image that's coming into my head is the difference between a grainy black and white image, like the kind you see from an ultrasound, as opposed to a photograph taken by a really good camera.
You know, that's not a terrible analogy. And think about how much information we get from these grainy ultrasounds, right? And
right.
if it were a choice between that and total darkness, oh, you'd love it.
Charles says the difference in audio quality is perhaps most noticeable when it comes to music. When we listen to music, our inner ear transmits a ton of information to our brain. Subtle differences between notes, volume, harmonies, and it's just too much to handle for the implant.
And there's all sorts of pitch distortions that happen all the way through, which I think introduces a lot of kind of unwanted and unplanned dissonance into the music. And we know that dissonance and consonance and the ability to perceive these things are directly related to the emotional impact of that music.
You're a musician, right?
Yes, I try.
What do you play?
I play saxophone is sort of the instrument that I've been trained in. I play some bass guitar. I play a moderate amount of piano. And my home has a bit of a music store quality to it. There's just instruments everywhere.
So music is on your mind. And when when you try to restore hearing to people, you think about the way they might perceive music. Why is that so important to you?
So I've always thought that as a musician, one of the biggest tragedies or the things that I fear the most is the possibility of one day losing my hearing. And so in my work as an ear specialist, a hearing specialist and an ear surgeon, I'm very acutely aware of the idea that I'm trying to help people avoid that kind of catastrophic ending. Meanwhile, if they've somehow lost their hearing, I'm trying to restore their life back to what it was. And for things like speech, we can do pretty well. But I'll tell you one thing for sure. If I lost my hearing, while I would be grateful to have speech perception, I would immediately, without a single moment's hesitation, I would just turn to music and I would want to have that sound back. And so that's why it matters to me.
Could you see a future where cochlear implants would work in a way that people could really enjoy music the way they were perhaps able to before?
Yes, I can definitely see a future where one day cochlear implants are providing high quality sound that allows you to hear music the way you remembered it and sort of what I call perfect hearing. Now, what I hope happens, and I think music's going to lead the way for us, I think that if you can hear music, you can hear anything. And so the original cochlear implants were designed around speech. So what I think has to happen is that they have to now be designed around music. And like I said, if the target of music perception can be achieved, I think from there you'll be able to hear anything, including speech. And so even though we've got a long way to go, think how far we've come in a relatively short period of time. So I do believe that at some point, the cochlear implant of the future will be capable of handling the full range of all music and sound and deliver it successfully to the auditory nerve. We just, it'll take a while for us to get there. I don't know if it'll be in my lifetime.
So we just have to sort of set the bar higher and start at a different starting point.
Yes, I think that it's, what has happened is people have been so amazed at the speech outcomes that to some extent, it's very tempting to just kind of congratulate yourself on this amazing thing you've achieved. You've been able to sort of reverse deafness and give sound back. And that's an incredible achievement. I mean, it's really like a life-changing thing. On the other hand, I think that like everything else in science and medicine, there's incremental progress towards a higher goal. And in this case, I think we have begun that journey, but we're not anywhere close to the end of it.
Charles Lim is a surgeon and an audiologist at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also a musician. Here he is playing one of his compositions. We've been talking about music as a transformative force on today's show. For Chrissy Tajin, music was the force that kept her from letting anxiety and agoraphobia close off more and more of her life. Music provided a bridge to the world. Chrissy is the singer and guitarist in the pop-punk band Thin Lips. Last year, her band recorded a new song, and while she was in the studio, she talked about how music helps her cope.
Franny, he's somewhere. He's trying to get his phone to work. Frampus, you want all the lyrics, right?
Yes, please.
Okay. Good luck reading them.
Socially anxious isn't necessarily what I am. That's kind of the complicated part, is I love people.
It's not that much of a slowdown.
I love meeting people. I love strangers. I love talking to people. So I'm not socially anxious. I am agoraphobic, so I'm afraid of fear. So situations that have caused me panic, I oftentimes avoid. Classic cases are elevators, airplanes, trains, tight spaces, like really kind of traditionally phobic things. It started when I was like 3 or 4, when my parents would drive on the highway. I was really afraid of big hills, and I remember feeling like I was like being crushed. Really weird feeling. Got so bad that my mom would have to drive me like kicking and screaming to the bus stop every day. She thought that I was being harassed at school in some capacity, and I wasn't. I was just like really afraid to be afraid because I didn't know how to handle it. It like kind of escalated to a point right before I went to college where I couldn't go outside, and when I did, I had like all these rules about how it had to be. Just to go anywhere would have to have like tons of water on me and like snacks and like all of these needs. My friend called it my Mojave pack because they said it was like I was crossing the Mojave Desert. Then I got kind of like well enough to go to college, and I kind of like backslid a couple times, and then I started playing in Dangerous Ponies. Our first tour, we did 7 days to Austin and back. That was terrifying. I took Klonopin the whole time and laid on the floor in the back of the van, and I was like a crazy person, but I kind of started to learn that it's okay to be afraid of things and how to expose myself to those things. Music has helped me overcome so many of my fears, like traveling. I just took a plane to Europe to go on tour. Like, when my friends found out that I went on a plane for the first time, like, the people that are really close to me, they were in shock. But I'm really different now. I feel lucky for that. I really learned that it's okay to be afraid of things, like, wildly phobic of things, and that I probably can't help it. Like, oftentimes my body is very nervous, but I can help what I do about it. It's very rare now that I, like, can't do something. But I still get nervous every time I play, every single time. And I've found systems to deal with that and created my own systems to deal with my anxiety. But if I avoid doing those things, then I kind of end up shutting myself out of the world and kind of back into that place where I am inside and not going outside again. You know, so it's important for me to do the things that scare me, or else, like, what's the point, you know? I make music because I have to. Music is like my therapy.
Oh, thank you.
Let's do a couple more.
Show me your love. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, that was so solid.
Chrissy Tejon is the guitarist and singer for the band Thin Lips. This piece was produced by Gabe Greenberg from the Philadelphia nonprofit Weather Vane Music. They do a video series called Shaking Through. It's all about the creative process, and you can watch more of Chrissy's story on their website. Our collaboration was made possible by a grant from the Scattergood Foundation for Behavioral Health. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhurov, and Alan Yu. Our interns are Elizabeth Estrada and Abby Holtzman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager and Alex Stern are our associate producers. Tanya English is our editorial director. Earlier on the show, we spent time with folk singer Sam Baker, and I recorded him as he played around with a new tune. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
You are such a beautiful light. You are such a beautiful light. You are such a beautiful light.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center supports The Pulse. With community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Penn's Heart and Vascular Center has made a commitment to deliver advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PENN. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.